My name is Deborah Greenhut, and my favorite thing is stories that repair reality.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and it is April already. Sunday, April 3rd. I was missing last week. I know I was missing in action. Luckily, Shai Corman from Friday Night Movie Podcast interviewed his neighbor, Katie Jones, about reality TV, and we snuck that one in. So hopefully you have had a chance to listen to that very fun conversation. It is heavy on 90s, early aughts nostalgia for reality TV, and great. And I'm grateful, as always, for Shai, when Shai steps in. Last weekend, I went to LA and took my computer and took my microphone and went to see a show, went to see How Did This Get Made live at Largo, and told very few people I was coming, which was good because mostly I hung out with my friend Esther and napped, slept, napped some more, and then went to Largo and called it a day, like called it a weekend and went to the airport. But I never had a moment to pull out my computer and edit the podcast, which I interviewed author Deborah Greenhut like the night before I went to LA. And so let's be honest, there was never a chance it was going to get done. I am continuing my healing journey. I finished radiation 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I'm getting my energy back. I still sometimes take naps that are, I'm just out cold. I'll sleep for a full day, or I will sit down and then wake up hours later. So I am still recovering from radiation and treatment. But I've started physical therapy, so I'm working on reconditioning my body, my core muscles, my knees, just trying to get stronger so that I can do things like walk to the train. My goal is that by May, I am commuting on the train again. But right now, I just can't imagine taking the risk that I wouldn't be able to get a seat on the train or even walking to the station right now. This week, I've got author Deborah Greenhut. Her first novel comes out on Tuesday, so it is publication week for her. It's called The Hoarder's Wife. So if you ordered it today, you would have it for the week of publication. And we have a really lovely conversation, wide-ranging, about her book, about Baking Challah, Joni Mitchell, jazz music. We really cover the gambit. Deborah was a really lovely person to have a conversation with. And without further ado, I'm going to let you listen, enjoy this episode with Deborah Greenhut. Get your boosters, wear your mask, and wash your hands, and keep enjoying your favorite things. Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things and we get recommendations without using an algorithm. This week, it's officially spring, and it is with that chilly and rainy in Chicago, and I am pleased to have with me today Deborah Greenhut. Deborah is an author with her... She's not a first-time author, but she is a first-time novelist. Her novel, The Hoarder's Wife, is coming out April 5th. So right around the corner, people can pre-order now and have it delivered on publication day. Deborah, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Thank you. And where, I like to imagine where people are. So where are you sitting tonight? Are you, where are you based?
I am based in New Jersey, about the center of the state, so we call it the gut. And not near the shore, not near the mountains. We do have some, and just right in the middle there.
Nice. Right, because the New Jersey's near the Poconos? Are those the mountains, or the Catskills, or both?
Some of New Jersey is near the Poconos, yes.
Okay. Are those the mountains you're near?
No, I'm actually not near anything, really. Oh, okay. I'm not too far from driving to the shore. Actually, it's not too far from anywhere in New Jersey to go. You could drive the whole state in a day easily. So
right.
It's not that that big a deal to drive. But I am in the center near Rutgers University, I guess would be the best way to position it. Exit 9, the way mm-hmm. we like to say it in New Jersey, on the turnpike. And my town actually has a sign that says the center of New Jersey. Welcome to the center of New Jersey.
Yeah, I do find that there's, I'm Midwestern, grew up in Indiana, live in Illinois now, but spent 3 years in Colorado and have definitely learned that, you know, what is like considered driving distance or close, the further west you go, the longer that distance gets. So
true,
in Chicago, right, people have houses in Michigan that are 3 to 5 hours away, and that's like a reasonable to go for a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like the further east you go, the distances get shorter of what is like a comfortable, quick trip.
Yeah, a lot of people don't like to drive into northern or central Vermont because it's over 5 hours to get there. So right. 4 hours is about the limit for most people.
Yeah. I love just how those sorts of things change for people. I think it's so interesting. Especially when I got to Colorado, I came with my Midwestern sensibilities. And then I found out if I was only willing to drive 3 hours, I wasn't going to get anywhere. Like Denver was 8 hours away from me. Albuquerque was 4 hours. Phoenix was 8 hours. Vegas was 8 hours. So I really had to extend what was worth driving for.
Absolutely. I had a job where I was on the road all the time. And so every night I was putting 400 or 500 miles on the car because this company had no mercy.
Wow.
So I know what that feels like. And in some cases where it's so rural and deserted, you think you've been driving for 10 or 12 hours because there's not much to look at, not much changes and no lights. Mm-hmm. So it's strange how your perception of distance really changes based on the landscape.
Yeah, it's so true. It's so true. I'm curious, tell me a little bit about your novel and how it came to be.
Okay, well, it's The Hoarder's Wife, and it's about a woman who has left a 35-year marriage and what is going to happen. And the reason I wrote it is because I did indeed leave a 35-year marriage to a hoarder. So it's not a memoir, mm-hmm. but I felt I wanted to look at, well, the big question that people always asked me during that time when I would complain about the situation was, why do you stay? And I never had a completely satisfactory answer to that question. I could come up with, well, the children, well, this, well, that. I knew I loved my husband, but I knew it was becoming very difficult. So mm-hmm. I wanted to look at a character in that same situation.
Wow. And how long after your divorce did you start working on the book?
Well, I think I started working on the book probably about 30, 25 years ago.
Okay.
Always making notes and thinking about it. But I didn't think I would ever actually write it or publish it. Unfortunately, we were divorced in 2012. And mm-hmm. then unfortunately, in 2016, my husband chose to take his own life.
Mm.
And that opened a door for me that probably wouldn't have existed as far as actually writing the book.
Okay. Because he died by suicide, he wasn't there to read the book or
exactly.
add his comments to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a solo now.
Yeah. And when did I've loved one of the things I've really enjoyed talking to writers about is when in this pandemic, where did the pandemic hit in your writing process for this novel? Had you sketched the whole book out pre-pandemic, or did the pandemic give you really a chance to sit down and write? Kind of what was the timeline once you really put pen to paper?
I had mostly finished the memoir that I thought I was going to write before the pandemic. So the pandemic was the opportunity to go back and say, well, I'm not sure I want this to be a memoir as much as I want to address the question. So there were certain liberties I got from making it a memoir that made it more literary and made the story make that kind of sense that I enjoyed. So during the pandemic, I really spent the time revising to make it a novel.
Wow. So it's people love to ask novelists, is it based on real life? So the question, the clear answer for you is yes.
Yes.
And did you go chapter by chapter, and then and you there were certain times where you were like, kind of, oh, I wish I had done XYZ, and you were able to give your character that freedom to do things you hadn't been able to do in your own life? Or was it just the ability to go further or bigger with different scenes?
Well, that was an interesting process because when I wrote the memoir, it needed to start at a certain place. Mm-hmm. And then when I started revising, I realized, no, that's not the right beginning for this.
Okay.
And it took me a long time to come up with a narrative frame for it, because what I wanted to do in the novel was to base it on the few days following the husband's death.
Mm-hmm.
And structure it according to what happened with the family on each of those days, while the character, whose name is Grace Berg, was rereading a journal that she had written during the 35 years she'd been married, which she had been forced to leave behind.
Okay.
So it was discovered on the table by a policeman, because they had to go through the house after this happened. And she, each night, well, during the day, she was working with her kids to try to sort out how they were going to do this funeral, which got complicated. Mm-hmm. Each night she would go home and read. And at some point she was skimming, so not reading the whole thing, but just reviewing her entire life and reflecting on it. So that's the narrative frame that I came up with, which I wouldn't have done with a memoir. It would have been a straight story.
Right. And that's also a framework that gives you the items in the house can have memories attached to them, or the rooms in the house and the journal. So that's a really interesting framework.
Thank you. It was enjoyable to do it then. I think the first questions I had about the revision were, how am I going to make this into a novel?
Mm-hmm.
And once I started looking at it as a journal, it wasn't my story anymore, which seems like a paradox at first, but it wasn't the memoir that I was writing anymore. It was a literary work that I had to create different characters for. Mm-hmm. Gave me some liberties about who the characters were, which I wouldn't have had in the memoir.
Right.
So it was kind of very freeing, finally. The memoir was very painful, but the novel was almost like a puzzle to figure out.
Wow. And what are some of your launch plans?
Well, COVID has interfered every time I've tried to set up a launch. So I'm having a series of readings among groups that I know and have worked with nearby. So we're doing some Zoom and some in person. I live in a retirement community, and I'm doing a reading there on Monday night. And then I belong to a group of independent scholars who are also writers. And I'll be doing a reading there in about a week, just a day before the actual publication.
Mm-hmm.
So beyond that, I'm not planning yet. I'm thinking, but it's been very difficult to get all my friends together to try to do something. And I've seen a few Zoom launches, and I'm not entirely satisfied with that. Reading online is not for me, the same kind of experience. So
yeah,
maybe delayed launch party anyway.
Did they push the pub date out too?
Well, originally it was going to be October, and then I hit some snags in the writing. So we decided to postpone it till April.
Great.
So it wasn't actually, I would say my publisher Woodhull was very on top of things, because as those supply chain shortages started to come up, they went ahead and printed. So the book is available already. And I think as they've started to ship it, so it should, if you order it, you should be able to get it, which is nice. So there shouldn't be any delays from that.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, that hit us at work. We were just trying to order. I work in marketing at a financial services company, and we were just trying to order like the navy blue backs to our, when we bind a presentation, and our paper guy was like, you can either order this much and get it now, or I don't know when. So
oh my.
There we go. There went Cowboy as promised.
Yeah, there was rough for a lot of different kinds of things.
Yeah.
There's parts and not just paper, but everything. Yeah.
Yeah, I was happy with my choice to buy it. I bought a used car in August of 2020, and it seemed like it was the right time to do that as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And then I was also looking. So in addition to the novel, you also have a series of children's books.
Yes, I do.
Were those, I don't want to make assumptions that you are a grandparent, but they were kind of, did you write those for kids in your life, or how did those come to be?
Well, it started out being for my grandchildren at the time. I have three, and they were all around. No, I'm sorry, I take that back. There were two. Another one has since come along, but I knew I would put them up on Kindle, but they were my first test readers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was in a way for them and something I hoped that they would enjoy. And I wasn't so worried about whether they would sell or not. That wasn't the important thing. What actually happened was after I was divorced, I figured my dream of being a writer probably wasn't going to come about because I had to work and I wasn't able to find any time with all that driving to make that work out. So I thought photography would be a good thing for me. And I do enjoy that. And I do find it very therapeutic. Then I discovered a watercolor app because I'm not a visual artist as a painter or anything like that. And I discovered a watercolor app, and that was just so enchanting. And the kids that I showed the books to were all enjoying them so much. So it was a nice combination of things that I like to do. And of course they're a little bit shorter than the type of writing I do as an adult.
Right.
So they were doable.
Right. So these are, for example, the Bonjour Paris book. So these are photographs that you took in Paris, and then you used the watercolor app to change them into illustrations.
Yes, I did. Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It was a lovely trip. I was actually taking a course in doing travel videos, which happened to me in Paris, which was a very nice coincidence.
Wonderful.
Not too bad, right? So I had lots of advice about how to take the pictures, and that unfortunately during the same time I was developing cataracts, and I noticed a lot of my photos were more blurry than I thought they were when I was looking through the lens. So watercolor is actually a great forgiveness thing because it prefers the blurry photo. You actually get more interesting effects from that. So
how interesting.
I'm safe now. Yeah, it was a funny discovery, but it actually worked well for me.
Yeah. Great. And those are available on Kindle. They're also, so they're on Amazon. The Hoarder's Wife comes out April 5th. So when I ask people to think about what they want to talk about, you said something in your reply that I've never seen before, and so I wanted to talk about it, which is that You wrote, "We can talk about why collections of things terrify me." Now that we've talked a little bit about your book, I feel like I might have an idea of the answer, but tell me more about why do collections terrify you?
Well, it does have a lot to do with hoarding. Let's see where to start. Well, there were many examples of hoarding, not to the extent that my husband became a hoarder, but in my own family before I met my husband. My mother, for example, saved every single scrap of paper in my dad's 50-year medical practice.
Oh, my goodness.
And that was not all she saved. When I think when I opened the attic door, as I was the one who had to clean out the house and after my parents passed away, and when I opened the attic door, there were 200 brown shopping bags in the attic. And I thanked her, but I thought, this is the strangest thing. Did she do this to help me, or was she just saving those bags?
So 200 bags empty, actual, waiting for you to fill and carry things out with.
Exactly. So, which was a little strange to me, but I knew I also had just a ton of paper and possessions. They saved everything. My parents, I don't know if my dad actually had anything besides a closet full of clothes and a dresser. I don't think there was anything in the house that was really his, but my mother collected reproductions of antiques. My mother collected antiques. She collected just about everything that she coveted. And she'd come from a family where she didn't have any money, was very poor. So I suspect some of it was that these things, she said her things always comforted her.
Yeah.
Which is a thing I think that many hoarders say. But
had she been alive during the Great Depression?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. She was also, I don't know if you want this long a story, but her mother died giving birth to her, and she was unfortunately given away to another family because her father had three older children and he didn't think he could manage. Now, the other family was quite good to her, and she was an only child, very generous, but then her foster father passed away when she was 10, and that was not a good thing for the family. They lost everything at that point. So my mother grew up taking care of her mother.
Wow.
So the sense of deprivation, my mother sold flowers on a street corner, and this just boggles my mind when I think about it, because that's not the woman I remember from my childhood. Not that she seemed fabulously wealthy or anything like that, but she just didn't seem like the insecure person who was coming out of that situation. And yet underneath it all, she was.
Yeah.
So there was that example. I was thinking about also, I have my mother's brother, whom she did reconnect with her siblings later on and developed a relationship with them. But my mother's brother was in World War II, was a part of the liberating force, and I believe it was Dachau.
Okay.
He went there, and the first person he met there was a woman lying on the ground trying to offer him some water, I believe. And this woman named Paula became his wife.
Wow.
So he brought her back, but she never, I only have sketchy details, but she never recovered from the experience.
Of course not.
Never. And at the end of her life, and this was spoken about in very hushed tones, so I pieced together some information. She would always save papers and things, and no one could convince her to throw them out, but she would take the little pieces of paper and stuff them into any possible opening to the outside world. So she had shut down the house as much as she could. And I guess in the last few weeks of her life, my uncle was afraid to go out because he was afraid she would finally seal it and he wouldn't be able to get back in. So this was a story from when I was fairly young.
Yeah.
Then I knew about hoarding. So it was rolling around in the back of my consciousness.
Yeah.
I'm forgetting your original question specifically, but those are two places where it came up early for me.
Yeah. Well, it was being terrified of collections.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So after I cleaned up my parents' house, and it was more than they had a lot of property, so there was more than one house to clean out. I became so repulsed by collections of things that I just wanted to throw out everything I had and be free of that. And unfortunately, my husband had escalated his own hoarding at that point. It was around the same time that he began to hoard furiously. And so every time I would try to take, well, even before that, if I tried to put something out in the trash, he would bring it back in.
Yeah.
And we just fought about this continuously, and neither of us really understood what was happening or why it was happening. And he eventually learned he had ADHD. And I understood that there was a connection there, but it was never, we could never get it addressed so that something could change. So I don't like being around a lot of, having a lot of things around me anymore. It just, it seems to create some anxiety for me that the walls are going to cave in, because our walls literally fell in some places. So I just, I want to know there's light and air.
Yes.
You see behind me some windows. I have big windows where I live now, and nothing sitting in front of them anymore.
Wow. That makes sense to me. That it makes a complete, I totally understand that reaction of wanting, especially after having to help clean multiple spaces and houses and of people that you love dearly, some of the closest people in your life, that I also think there's some of not wanting to then put that on someone else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I told my husband I could not do that to my children, and he just didn't go along with that. He wanted his things around him. So,
My mom calls it, I believe it's Swedish death cleaning.
Yes.
And it's not, she's like, it's not KonMari what I'm doing. It's Swedish death cleaning. It's getting the house ready for you kids, so that it's easier for you.
That is a great kindness, I think, when a parent can think about that far in advance for a child.
What are the things to save? You know, what are the things that we'll want that my nephews will want to take on into their houses, and what are the things that can find new lives today? All those questions.
Yeah. Someone told me when I was in the thick of cleaning out that people always think that their things are more valuable than they actually are. And they think they're saving something, you know, a real treasure for their kids. And there are certain things that are keepsakes, and certainly you want to pass those along. But basically, I've discovered your kids don't want your stuff.
Right. It's true. The thing I'm looking for right now is somewhere in Chicago. I know that someone's kid doesn't want their like heavy oak 1980s, early 90s dining room table with like a lot of leaves in it, but that gets pretty small. That's the dining room table I'm hoping that somebody's kid my age doesn't want that I can find.
You may get lucky.
Yeah. I keep going online looking for dining room tables, and I'm like, but where are the dining room tables that we grew up with that could get really, you take all the leaves out, they get really small, but then you can have a big dinner, but they don't. I currently have a conference room table for my dining room table, and it's just too big.
Yeah.
That's
nice to be able to fold it up. I get that.
Yeah. Well, during 2 years of not being able to have people over for dinner, having a giant dining room table became more and more ridiculous.
Oh, you didn't spread out all your projects on the table?
It is covered in candy. I have a second podcast about candy. Called Candy Chat Chicago, and my dining room table is covered in candy, just bowls, and I can't bake anymore because all of the bowls I would use for mixing dough are currently full of candy. So, well, thank you for elaborating on that. what is something that you think would be fun to dive into? I think any one of these would be great to dive into. But what is something that you would have fun talking about this evening?
Well, maybe since we're talking about food, we'll start with challah.
Yes.
Sound good? So delicious.
Ah.
Well, when I was a little girl, I always loved it, of course, but someone else was always baking it. And my mother was a good cook, but she never learned how to bake bread. She had a lot of I Love Lucy moments with yeast, so she gave it up.
Yes.
And when I got married, I wanted to learn to do it. I really loved the idea of a Shabbat dinner and trying to preserve at least some of those customs in our mm-hmm. house. And my mother-in-law was a great baker, and she did bake challah. And she would always say to me, one day I'm going to show you how to do it. This was the first few months of our mm-hmm. marriage. And I could never pin her down to make that happen. And I noticed that when she gave me other recipes, of course, she would leave something out. So, you know, I'd have to figure it out. Which, you know, it's just an apocryphal story in many families. But one day I had gotten a lot of cookbooks when I got married they gave me a cookbook shower. And I finally had a chance to look through them. And all of a sudden I found this cookbook called The Settlement Cookbook, which is all German Jewish mm-hmm. cooking. And it was from the settlement house where many immigrants learned to do their things. And I think my mother-in-law actually went there to learn how to become a chef and a caterer. But that aside, I found the cookbook and I'm looking through it, and all of the cakes seem to be like the ones that she made. Those seem to be the recipes. And I started trying them and I was able to do it. My father-in-law made the greatest sin of all, of course, and told me that my pound cake was better than his wife's pound cake, uh-oh. Which started a war. So
one, because you finally were able to make it using all of the ingredients instead of all but one ingredient probably helped.
Exactly. Exactly. That was great. And I didn't want to gloat or, you know, it, but right. it was kind of a vindication. Now I know what's wrong. It's not me. It's the recipe. And then one day I got really brave and I decided to make a challah. It was Jewish New Year. And I said, I'm doing it this year. And I had visions of my mother and stuff spilling all the yeast going all over the place and so on, but I did it. And it was the most transformative cooking experience I've ever had. And while I was kneading the dough and watching it become what it was supposed to become, I just thought if everyone would bake bread, there couldn't be any war in the world mm-hmm. because this is the most whole, fulfilling thing I have ever done, I think. I didn't have any children yet, but I just felt like the dough and the consistency of it and having it on your hands and then it the way it morphed and changed mm-hmm. into the dough it was supposed to be. And I just from then on making the challah every year was a real treat for me. I haven't made any in a few years, but I made a point of doing it and my kids loved it and you know helped me with the poppy seeds and so on. And it was just such a lovely thing to have in my life. So those memories and the bread itself is one of my favorite things.
Yeah. When I converted to Judaism, I got really obsessed with the idea of making challah. Did any of my girlfriends make challah? No. Did they were like, Leah, we don't bake it ourselves. We go to a bakery. Like people were really like, no, we don't. Of course we don't make it. So like nobody really had many tips for me. And I had this really basic book about like making a Jewish home, and it's still the recipe I use to this day. But the first time first couple of weeks I made challah, I underkneaded it. Like I didn't know. I'd never made bread from scratch before. We had a bread maker machine growing up. So I just sort of like got it to the where it was sticky and I was like, I guess I mixed it. And that makes a huge, I mean, the bowl would be like a foot above the bowl rising because there was no, I hadn't like made any gluten in it. Like I hadn't activated the proteins. So it would just make the huge loaves of challah that were delicious, but like just, you know, single, living alone. And it was good for French toast, but I was like, how are you supposed to make two loaves of this every week when this huge bread? And then one week I tried it with wheat flour, and that was a disaster because I didn't understand that wheat flour and white flour are actually very different. Yes. So I made like the densest challah I'd ever made in my life. And then finally I got a tip from our rabbi's wife, both of blessed memory, Lotta Schalman, who came from Austria when she was in her late teens. So she escaped the war. She and her husband, Rabbi Schalman, lived to be like 100 and 101 and died within days of each other a few years ago. But when she would take the women, when there would be like a camp weekend or something, she was teaching or baking challah, not just women, but with like the people of the synagogue who wanted to bake challah. She said that the dough is the right consistency when it feels like a breast. Like when it feels like a woman's breast, it is the right consistency, and that's when you can let it rise. Which I wasn't needing it to that point.
Yeah.
it was just like a sticky, I don't even know what I was making. But I love making challah. I love making and I guess because I didn't grow up Jewish or grow up seeing people bake challah for Rosh Hashanah, how I make my round challah. This is like, I guess, a very Chicago answer to making a round challah for Rosh Hashanah is I bought a deep dish pizza pan and I make two braids and I put it in this deep dish pizza pan. And so I end up with like a large pizza sized wreath of challah for Rosh Hashanah.
That's lovely. Mm-hmm. Wow. I never thought about it, but the tactile memory is coming back, but that's exactly right. What you're about. I've said. Exactly.
And it keeps her memory alive for me. She was just a Spitfire who was sent to live with family in Danville, Illinois from Austria. And after she was there for a while, they were like, well, we're not going to get her married off here. We've heard... maybe she was from Germany, but like we've heard some single rabbinical students are at HUC in Cincinnati. So we'll send her to Cincinnati because there are some single rabbinical students there and maybe she can marry one of them. And Rabbi Schalman picked like the short straw and got to go on a date with her. And then the day he graduated seminary, he sent out wedding invitations and did not fully have her on board with getting married. But then they were married for 65 years and truly like deeply in love with each other. So it was quite the love story.
That is a beautiful story.
Yeah. Did you ever stray from the traditional challah recipe? You mentioned poppy seeds. Do you do raisins or chocolate chips or are you pretty much a poppy seed challah?
I don't mind eating the others, but in my own cooking, I just feel I'm a purist about it. So mm-hmm. Traditional.
Yeah.
How about you? What's your favorite?
I like with poppy seeds and I'll do raisins for Rosh Hashanah. But I feel like I've never mastered kneading the raisins in. I feel mm-hmm. like they make it like the surface break a little bit more.
They would probably create some cracks if all is not well.
I'll certainly do I'll do that, but I've never done like I've never done a Nutella. I've never added dye to it. I'm not very fancy with my challah.
I'm always afraid there's going to be a glob of something like peanut butter or Nutella or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I don't want that taste when I when I eat it. I want the texture to be bread.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I just want to, I don't know. I love it. I love, yeah, I haven't made it in a few years, in part because my social circle has gotten just a lot of allergies and a number of people who can't do gluten.
Gluten, right.
And I am not a skilled enough baker to do gluten-free challah. I'm afraid it would be very bad and then would end up with nothing. So we purchased.
That's not right.
Right. Yeah. What are some of your other, when you think about, like, what were there other Jewish traditions that you tried to bring into your house or other holidays?
Our children had very conventional Orthodox, almost Orthodox, very high conservative bar mitzvahs. Mm-hmm. So for the first, let's say, 13, 14 years of their lives, we did go to a conservative temple. It was actually a Sephardic temple. Well, we're Ashkenazi, but yeah. When we went there was actually an Ashkenazi rabbi who had to sign an oath he wouldn't change any of the rituals. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how it happened that he was assigned there, but he was. And he was very forgiving of children. So while they separated men and women, it was only like not even a solid barrier. We were all on one floor in an assembly hall where the sanctuary would open up into this multipurpose room, and mm-hmm. the women would be mostly in the multipurpose room. But there was lots of going back and forth because the barrier really didn't keep anybody out or in anywhere. Yeah. So it started off being, a little forgiving and lackadaisical about some of the rules. But then we got an extremely religious rabbi, and he was the one who was responsible for bar mitzvahing my children. And it was a pretty stringent requirement. And we just didn't know at that point where to go. We didn't mm-hmm. want to shift to it. There were mostly Reform temples otherwise. And we didn't want to go to a super Orthodox one, even if it was Ashkenazi. So we stayed there. And it was hard on the kids, I think. There were, they were good about it, but there were so many rules, and the greater hypocrisy of religious observance became very apparent. And, yeah. And they would go religiously, I'm going to put that in quotes, religiously to their Hebrew lessons and show up and so on. And there was a president of the congregation who would promise an award to the person who did that. And my kids always were the ones who did it, and they never got the award that was supposed to happen. There's supposed to be a baseball tickets to Yankees tickets one year, and these things never happened. So my kids got a little distorted view of some of these things. And I'm not sure why they offered a reward when the reward probably should have been the feelings themselves, the spiritual feelings that were being developed. So we didn't even know why they started a reward thing. It just seemed like something you're supposed to do. My husband and I were both very good doobies most of our earlier mm-hmm. lives anyway. So we didn't see we never got rewarded for learning our own Hebrew lessons and so on. But actually I did not have a bat mitzvah because my grandfather founded an Orthodox congregation in Yonkers, mm-hmm. New York, where I'm from. And my mother and father secured Hebrew lessons for me with a tutor. And when I was 13, my mother said, well, when are we going to start learning her Haftarah? And the Hebrew teacher looked shocked. And he said, girls don't have a bat mitzvah. Orthodox people don't do that. That's not true anymore, but it was true at the time. And my mother was heartbroken, and I was flabbergasted because I was being prepared. I was looking forward to it.
Right.
And so I didn't do it. I might do it. I guess at 84, men are allowed to be bar mitzvahed or something. So yeah. I don't know if I'll wait that long, but I might actually do it at some point.
It's such a wonderful experience because we had, so I converted in my late 20s. And so I became bat mitzvah when I was 30. It was the first time I read from Torah. Mm-hmm. And a few years prior, we had actually done a number of group bat mitzvahs at my synagogue for women who had been denied the experience. Mm-hmm. So sometimes they would do it all on their own. My friend Shifra had one like totally her own when she was, I think when she was maybe turning 60, she did one. So it's never too late to read from Torah and Haftarah for the first time, like publicly. Yes.
Yeah.
And it's so meaningful.
I imagine it. I've seen a few women go through it, and a couple of relatives have done that at 80. They decided to do it, and my temple actually has a program for that. So I'm thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I had invitations printed as kind of almost as if I was 13. They were like pink and purple, and they folded up, and they were Hebrew on this side and English on this side. I mean, I was 30, I'm 45 now. I've still never been married, but at 30, I like really felt it. So I was like, there's going to be these nice paper invitations, and this is just going to be the biggest party. And there was a really nice like fish platter for the kiddush. And it was, and friends had the party at their house. It was just super fun.
Did you get a lot of fountain pens though? I have to ask.
No, I did just get a fountain pen though. This year I've got a really nice episode about fountain pens, and I told my sister to listen to the episode and that I wanted a beginner fountain pen. So I got one this year
at last. Yes. I'm sorry I interrupted you. You were saying how meaningful it was to you, and that's an important thing to say.
It was very meaningful. I really appreciated being able to give, like, to give honors during the service and ask the people at your synagogue that are, for me, it was a lot of our kind of stalwart elders who I didn't know, but who were there every Shabbat, and asking them to open the ark or light the candles and do different blessings, and to be able to say thank you for supporting this congregation and making a community for me to come into when I converted. So that was really meaningful to me. And it was a great, opportunity to share what Shabbat was like with my family who's not Jewish.
That is lovely. And being part of a community is most of what this is about. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wrapped, well, now a year ago, I was president of my synagogue for 2 years, for like the first 2 years of the pandemic, which was a hard time to be a president of a synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
I don't suggest it.
Don't think I would take the job.
Don't do it. All right. Now I'm curious, you have for music, Joni Mitchell and Laura Nyro. I know some Joni Mitchell, probably more than I think. I feel like she's an artist that, you know, if I were really to dive in, I'd be like, oh, I do know that song. I know that song, but I can't. Suddenly I have amnesia and I can't think of a single Joni Mitchell song. But tell me a little bit about Joni Mitchell and Laura Nyro and how you heard them for the first time and what they mean to you as musicians.
Okay, I think both of them I heard for the first time in high school. Mm-hmm. So that would be in the mid to late 60s, let's say, before 1969 and before that. And at that point, Laura Nyro's voice was just something out of the blue. Just a powerful, powerful soprano. And the lyrics were stories, which is the same, I could say, of Joni Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
So in my head, those melancholy times of high school where nothing is working out right, these mm-hmm. two women just sang something to me, more so Laura Nyro at first, I would say, because she started off, you probably know Wedding Bell Blues or Eli and the 13th Confession, maybe mm-hmm. you've heard. But I guess Joni Mitchell might be more familiar. She started more in the folk singer realm, like Judy Collins and a few other women singers. And but at a certain point, her voice was very interesting. She also used 12-string guitar. So her guitar tunings were unlike anyone else's. No one else was that sophisticated a player. And eventually she became a jazz composer, jazz musician as well. But I think the period that, of course, sticks with me was just a couple of years after that. When I was in college, the so-called Blue Album, not so-called, it was the Blue Album came out. And the narrative in that album just, it captured the, you know the song Woodstock, I would imagine, which is also one of hers. But this story of a woman with a man who never quite responds to the image in her heart of what she wants to have in a lover, but she must be with him. That was, you know, just encapsulated everything about college years in those times. I'm 70, so we're thinking about the era of free love and hippies and the idea of wandering through life with someone and not tying it down. She had a song, My Old Man, is a singer in the park. We don't need a piece of paper from the city hall keeping us tried and true. My old man singing away the blues. And that was the ideal that a lot of people were striving for, that we didn't need any paper. We were independent. And it wasn't just the lyric, though, the story that she was telling, but the way the music emulated all the feelings that she was expressing. Mm-hmm. And she just had the capacity to weave her voice around these words in ways that no one else really was doing at the time. It was a very creative time, I think, in music. I feel the stories were stories and lyrics were a lot more powerful than we have now, except in some cases. So I guess another song I think about is Case of You. And there was a certain, even though there was a certain free love magnet at the time, and people were very attracted to that idea that you didn't need any legal ties and so on, there was a sort of a fight back to be independent at the same time, which I think, you know, you probably also saw in the women's movement at the time and some other developments. But she had one song that, I could drink a case of you and still be on my feet. So just that sense of equality, which never quite came about. So beautifully idealistic in a lot of her music, that we could stand up to each other and still be with each other. And that's something I guess that was my fantasy, that's the way it was supposed to be. So that would be more about Joni Mitchell, but Laura Nyro was really tragic. She died too young of cancer, and a lot of other people covered her songs and made them more mainstream than she ever could. Her voice was unique, and a lot of people didn't like it. I had some friends who were male who used to call her "Screaming Lady" whenever girls put her on the. I was going to say the record player. Yes, I have to say record player. Yeah. In that case. But when her voice would come out loud and would just run out of the room, you know, so it's only girls listening to her, and it was hauntingly beautiful, her voice. And Three Dog Night did Eli and the 13th Confession, and just a whole different kind of orchestration to it. So that was the one that became popular. And the Fifth Dimension sang a lot of her songs, Soul Picnic and Wedding Bell Blues were a couple. So these two singers and a number of others, but I think these two really carried me in terms of the mental journey I was taking at the same time. They're a little bit older than I was, but not much. And their independence was just so admirable to me. You know, little did I know the terrible things that both of them were going through at times, but they also had just mystical, magnificent lives as far as I was concerned, being traveling the world as singers. I thought that was quite romantic and aspirational.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly seems that way, especially when you're in college and and you just see the singers, the artists that you love, and they're traveling, and I mean, even more so pre-social media, when the stories you were getting about them were exactly the stories they wanted you to hear. It was their music and like drips of information about their personal lives, but it wasn't so much that we know now, that you were able to fill in the story in a different way based on their music.
And they were really troubadours. They were bringing back news from other places. You know, mm-hmm. you got some of your information about what it was like to backpack in Europe from singers who went there before we all started to do it.
Yeah.
Not that I did it, but my friends all started to do it. So I took graduate school over the backpack to Europe trip. So that was my mistake. Not my mistake, but two roads diverged.
Yeah. Yeah. Were you ever able to see either of them perform live?
I saw Joni Mitchell, and I did not get to see Laura Nyro, and I so wanted to do that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, Joni has, I mean, she's still performing, so, right? A little bit.
No, she's had some sort of Judy Collins still performs.
Okay.
Occasionally, although her voice, she went through a terrible crisis with her voice. It's not as powerful as it once was. Mm. And I think as we get older, the range is going to collapse a little bit too.
Right.
But she does still sing. And Joni Mitchell has had, they were very guarded about what it was exactly, but some sort of mental incident, brain incident. Mm. So I'm not sure if she had a stroke. So I apologize to anyone who's listening who might be upset that I'm trying to talk about this, but
I will, so, I'll find an article and I'll add it to the show notes. So don't worry.
Okay. So she doesn't perform. They did honor her at the Kennedy Center recently. Okay. And she was there and she's able to speak, but I think for a while she wasn't even able to speak. Mm. So sounded like stroke, but I'm not sure. I can't say that I follow it all as much as I used to. Too many distractions on Facebook. So,
right.
But I will never forget, you know, that album. I must have worn it down to, you know, threads from playing it over and over mm-hmm. and over in the same day, over and over and over. It was just such a set of anthems for that time period.
Yeah. Yeah, there's really something special when you find an album that provides the anthems of a chapter of your life.
Yes. Yes. Do you have one?
There's Natasha Bedingfeld has an album called Unwritten that I listened to a lot when I was kind of late 20s and doing a lot of writing. And so that is one that if I ever need to get into the zone and just crank out some words, like Natasha Bedingfeld, that it really works for me. And then I think, you know, like Alanis Morissette, Jagged Little Pills, which is, I think, you know, a very, very Gen X answer, but it's such a great angsty college album.
Yeah, I love that one, too.
That's good.
Very, very good. Yeah.
But now I don't have I don't listen to as much music as I used to. I'm much more likely to have a podcast on, especially since the first lockdown, because I was spending so much time alone that I really came to rely on podcasts to provide company.
Yeah.
Like the presence of other people. Other voices.
Human voices.
Mm-hmm. So I just like walk around with my phone playing a podcast, have my phone shoved in my bra, and pretend like there were people in my house.
Yeah, I walk about 4 or 5 miles a day now, and I devote half of it to listening to podcasts and the other half to listening to music. And I have a pretty eclectic collection of things in my head that I like to listen to. So, nice. So I never run out, but it's more jazz than anything else at this point. But
yeah,
I guess because the lyrics are not, I don't know, their songs are not as appealing.
Yeah. Who are your, what are some of the jazz musicians that you'll walk to?
Well, I think I mentioned Miles Davis, and that's actually my writing music. There's a song called So What on his Kind of Blue album, and it's one of the most exquisite uses of instruments to sound like conversation that I've ever heard. So it always gets me thinking in terms of what I'm going to put on the page. Like if I were scoring that, or if I were writing lyrics for that song, which is the story or whatever I'm working on now, what would it sound like? And that rhythm of it, which is very syncopated, gets me off of whatever writer's block I came into the room with.
So
I often do that. And I guess I do listen to a lot of anthologies of Paris kind of music. So things like La Vie en Rose will keep me going, walking for a long time, even though it's not a very bouncy song that keeps you walking. I can just keep going when I hear it. Or let's see, in terms of jazz, I'm trying to think. This morning I didn't listen to any music, which is not usual, so my mind is going blank. But I like Diana Krall, and I enjoy Sorry. Now I can't think of any jazz. I'm thinking Nora Jones.
Amnesia. It happens. It happens.
Yeah.
I definitely had a. I was in high school. I was in basically any band I was allowed to be in. So I was in marching band. I was in concert band. I was in jazz band. And I went through a few years where I thought good music didn't have words. So I listened to classical and jazz instrumentals constantly. And so Take Five will always stop me in my tracks, no matter what I'm doing. Gustav Holst's The Planets, which is not jazz, but if The Planets ever somehow comes on, that's a symphony that really, really works for me. And then I think it's Take the A Train. There are trains in New York that as they start heading off out of the station have the first two notes of Take the A Train. I don't live in New York, but it's something that anytime I go there, I'm I'm not on the A Train, but it still sounds like the first two notes of it. But it's a very hard thing to explain to people that I'm walking with, just listen to what it sounds like when the wheels scrape the track. It's these two notes. I'm ready to go back to New York.
Yeah, I miss it. I haven't been for 2 years, which is so unlike me.
Yeah.
I grew up just north of the city. I could walk to the Bronx from my house, and I can't believe I didn't go, but I just couldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was so, Manhattan in particular was so scary during the pandemic, we're still in the pandemic, but in the pre-vaccine days of the pandemic.
Once Broadway shut down, that was the end of life as we know it for me. But no, I got my brain cell back on the jazz question, and my dad was a pretty talented piano player, he made sure I got lessons, and I was actually trained to be a concert pianist.
Wow.
Which was never going to succeed. My hands are too small, so people can't see them, but they are. Mm-hmm. So my repertoire was not going to be very big. And I knew that from a pretty early age, but I did study and I enjoyed it. Although my teacher was really fierce, and too fierce for a child, I think.
Oh.
But later on, later on I appreciate it, but the reason I brought up both my dad and the piano teacher is that we had an electrified piano, a player piano in our basement. And the Aeolian company was the company that used to make the piano rolls.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad, that was the one thing he did collect was Aeolian piano rolls. And he only wanted originals because in many cases, the ones he liked to collect were George Gershwin, and Gershwin himself had done the fingering on the piano for the master cut of those piano rolls.
Oh.
And my father would sit in the basement. He didn't take off a lot of time, but sometimes in whatever spare time he had, he would go downstairs and I would see him and his hands would be moving with George Gershwin's fingers, in his head over the music. And he'd be singing. And it was the most peaceful, really, that I ever saw him. He was a physician and very driven person, but this was how he relaxed. So Gershwin is always rolling around in my head. And I often listen to Gershwin while I'm walking or Cole Porter. Same kind of reason.
Wow. I never thought much about how player pianos got their movement.
Yeah, somebody had to play it into
Right.
a master cylinder, and then they cut all the rolls from that. So it was George Gershwin who did Rhapsody in Blue, and that was my dad. Feeling it through the piano somehow. And Gershwin, actually, his mother, I think, was a friend of my grandmother's. And they used to play cards together. So my dad didn't, I guess he didn't know him because he died before, I think before my dad was born or when he was a little boy. The grave of Gershwin is actually in the same cemetery where my parents were buried. But my father would go to visit the grave, and it's in the middle of this sort of nondescript place, but people are still leaving flowers and mementos and all sorts of, like, he's Marilyn Monroe on the Gershwin mausoleum, and it's so remarkable. And I remember he just hero worshiped George Gershwin. That was one of his favorite people. So.
Great. Well, Deborah, is there anything about your book, about making challah, about music? I mean, I know that we could go on talking all evening, that we haven't mentioned, that if we hung up, you would regret not talking about.
I guess a little about the book. It's only right. I wrote it because I know that a lot of people get stuck and think that they can't retrieve a life or make a life for themselves when they have spent so long trying to make sure the other person was okay. And I didn't think I was going to be okay. I didn't think I could leave. So I wrote it to show both in word and deed that if you can recover some of your old creativity, whatever it was that brought you to the place where you married this person or decided to live with this person, that's still in there. The things that you loved and the things that you could do, and it's a good starting place for making the motion out, because it is very difficult to leave once the interdependence becomes as profound as it was for me. So I wanted to tell that story for lots of literary reasons, and I've always been a writer. I hope it will help people to see that it's possible to have a life anyway.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, I look
Thank you.
forward to reading it and to your publication date, April 5th. People can pre-order now. Are you active on social media? Do you want people to follow you on the internet?
Sure. They can I have a Facebook page. I have an author page now too, so that's probably the better place to go. The other things might not be interesting to everybody else. I have a website, deborahgreenhut.com, and let's see, LinkedIn page. So I look forward to hearing from anyone who wants to correspond. That's great.
Great. Well, congratulations. And thank you for joining me tonight. It's
It
been
was a real
lovely.
pleasure. Thank you so very much for inviting me to this interview. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.